Edition, another is additions a good another chapter, another episode of Blind Like Me. It's Phil Parr coming into your homes and your wherever you are, places of business. Nice to have you with us. It's a pretty, as I was telling Jeff, it's a pretty sunny day in East Texas. We haven't seen much sunshine in the last couple of weeks, but today my dogs are running and jumping and fetching, as the song says, chasing that squirrel, but they ain't gonna catch him. I can bet on that. And as we've alluded to, our friend is Jeff Kissaker from way up in the North Country. Jeff, how are you, sir?
I'm well, Phil. How are you today?
As I said, I'm better, much better with the little sunshine. It makes
no doubt.
Oh, it makes things much, it's much better. We're not used to this cold stuff in East Texas. We, LA, they had that little ice last week, and they postponed school openings till 9 o'clock. You know, and it's just. We just, us Texans, just can't handle this this cold stuff. But anyway, where are you? I've forgotten.
I'm in Fort Pierce, South Dakota, which is right in the middle of the state, actually, on the Missouri River.
That's Fort Pierre or Pierce?
Pierre. It's spelled Pierre, like yeah, the French Pierre, but they pronounce it Pierre.
Fort Pierre, South Dakota. Well, that's it's not a big city. Obviously, it's a town of about how many?
The town is probably about 1,500 or so.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Actually, there's only in the county. There's probably more cattle than people.
Yeah, I always thought I'd like to live in a town that size where you could walk to places, you know, where you could live almost downtown and you could walk to a bar, you could walk to the grocery.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's the town is really not that big. It's growing though. It's kinda nice. We are a growing community instead of a shrinking one where most small towns are shrinking.
Oh, that's true. Do you have a radio station there?
We have a couple of different radio stations and companies here that have everything from top 40 to country on the FM, and then AM is just kind of an all-over-the-road kind of thing in a country station.
Lots of talk and lots of preachers and stuff like that on AM these days. So
yeah, there is a lot of talk and political stuff on the radio.
How did you get there? Is this your home? Was this originally your place of birth?
I grew up in a town called Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and that's Sioux like Sioux Indian.
Yeah, we all know about Sioux Falls. We've heard of that.
And Sioux Falls is... on the eastern part of the state, in the southeastern part of South Dakota, and it's a town of about, I think they just did another estimate of about 150,000 now or so population. I lived there, I grew up there, went to school there with college, and then ended up moving to Pierre for a job, actually, so...
So Sioux Falls was originally your home. That's where you grew up, and that's a pretty good-sized town, although it is not the capital, is it?
No, Pierre, South Dakota is the capital.
Pierre, and it's actually pronounced Pierre, South Dakota.
Correct.
That's one of the things Miss Wynn drummed into my head as a child. I know those states and capitals. Sioux Falls, and your parents lived there, and you went to school there. You went to, did you go to public school, or what?
I went through public schools all the way through, yeah.
Never a blind school, never, except maybe in the summer?
Never, not even in the summer.
Really?
I was in first grade when the School for the Blind at that time was really recruiting students, and they sent somebody, or that person went to my school and about this time of year and said to my teacher that I couldn't function in the classroom.
Yeah.
My teacher said, well, he's already doing it. And the principal got, she called the principal in, and the principal told the lady from the school for the blind not to come back to his school, and that I was doing just fine, and I did.
Jeff is doing just fine. Just leave him alone right here.
Yep.
That's great, because
real progressive, you know, when I was in school. So.
Yeah, because oftentimes you don't get that support from, they don't want to fool with you if you're blind.
Absolutely.
But obviously you were doing well, and they did. Now, what years were this? Were back in the 50s, back
no,
in the 60s?
In the early 70s.
Early 70s. So things had progressed a lot by then as far as educating, mainstreaming, what we call mainstreaming kids.
I think so that mainstreaming was really just kind of starting to hit when I kind of started it. You know, I was kind of a pioneer as far as students who were blind in our school district. And actually, they didn't even hire, they hired a blind specialist to work with kids who were blind and teach Braille and that kind of thing after a couple more kids who were blind came into the district. So I, at that time, was able to read using a magnifying glass and CCTV. I was a pioneer in using a CCTV as well. So.
Okay, so you, at that point in time, you had a little sight.
Sure. I was about 2,400, I think, in my good eye, and probably about 2,600 in the bad eye until I was about 13.
And you could read the books as they were printed for sighted children with a magnifying glass.
Right, and they also did have large print books for me as well.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, large print. They probably had lots of large print. So that's how you got back. Of course, you couldn't see the blackboard.
Nope, I couldn't see the blackboard. I couldn't read the overheads. They had the old mimeograph worksheets and stuff,
mm-hmm.
that purple ink, those were hard to read even with magnification. But I got through it, and actually it wasn't until after I'd lost the vision where I couldn't visually read anymore. I was an excellent speller up till that point.
Yeah, and then you don't. A lot of our spelling problem, like that I have, is I've never seen the word. Luann, when you ask her to spell a word, a lot of times she'll say, "I can spell it if I write it down." She'll write it down and nail it every time. You know,
she's absolutely. And if you don't see the word, and then I started reading with Braille and contractions, and so in using contractions, you don't think of how the word's spelled. You think, okay, .5D is the word day. You don't even think
D-A-Y.
So. Yeah. I lost a lot of spelling in my middle school years from, 7th, 8th, 9th grade. And then when I got into high school, they started pushing me to type. And I'm like, okay. And then I had to really rethink how to do things. And I was really glad when computers came along because it really helped me. I'm, not the best speller now, but I'm a lot better than I used to be.
What? And they did. They finally hired a teacher to teach you. But in the early grades, you didn't know Braille. You didn't have Braille.
I did not have Braille until I was in seventh grade. And when I was in seventh grade, I was still reading print with the CCTV and magnifiers and stuff, and I had really thick Coke bottle bottom glasses. And they said, "Oh, you're going to start learning how to read Braille today." And I'm like, "No, I'm not. I don't need that. I can read." And they just tried to pop it on me and force it on me. And the more they force, the more, of course, being in seventh grade, the more you're going to resist.
Yeah.
And I think if they had taken a different approach with me, it would have been a little easier for me to receive it. But also, due to some medical things with my eyes over that between seventh and eighth grade, if they'd have waited a year, I wouldn't have resisted it.
But they finally won, and you did finally learn Braille.
I know how to read it, but I've never been real fluent at it.
Uh-huh. What happened to your eyes in during that period of time?
Well, I was born with cataracts, and I'm 41 now. I was born in 1965.
Uh-huh.
They didn't do surgery on babies until they were older in those days, and so they waited till I was about 9 months old. Well, eyes don't develop real well after that. And so I cataracts when I had those removed and the astigmatism. And then that summer between 7th and 8th grade, I had they detected a detached retina in one eye and glaucoma in the other eye, and I did lots of trips from Sioux Falls to Iowa City, Iowa, where the University of Iowa Hospital is. We did about 10 trips between June 1st and the end of August, which is about an eight-hour drive. So.
But they couldn't save your eyes.
They couldn't save my eyes. The glaucoma had really progressed, and the retinal, they tried to reattach the retina, and it was just, it didn't reattach at all. So, so I started really quickly losing vision in the right eye due to the glaucoma, but pretty much have no useful vision anymore.
It's like nature decided that one way or another, by God, this kid's going to be blind.
Absolutely.
You know.
Sure seemed that way. That was a hell of a summer, to be honest with you. It was really hard.
I imagine it was at that age. It was terrible.
It's tough to be 13 anyway, you know. And then you add on the fact that you're losing vision. You didn't have a lot to start with, and then you're losing what you had. And a lot of psychological stuff really happened.
Sure.
I was, didn't eat. I went through some depression, but you know, it was kind of weird. I just kind of ended up popping out of that depression, and two, 3 days later, I was riding a bike again. And
yeah, you feel like the world has come to an end. That the world, why me, Lord, kind of thing.
Yeah, I've done that periodically. You know, there have been times of real frustration where it's like, you know, I'm real sick of this.
I think all blind people, or most blind people, go through some period of time and wonder. You wonder why. I've wondered. You know, I've thought, you know, my big dog Frankie can see wonderfully. Why can't she give me her eyes? You know, that's not possible, and I know that's stupid. But she can see, and I can't. Why is that? And I'm, you know, you think about silly things. I think all blind people go through some depression and frustration.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think that's pretty normal. I think it's normal for any really disability, really. You know, people who use wheelchairs to be able to say, well, like, you know, I'd really like to walk up that flight of steps, you know. That kind of thing. So I think it's pretty normal, but at the time you're experiencing it, it's not normal, and you're the only one, and there's no real way that you can tackle that. Except to really confront it and say, you know what, piss on it. I'm going to do this.
Yeah. And I did, and if you heard last week's show, and I already haven't run it yet, but I'm going to run it this week. A lady who is in a wheelchair has very little use, no use of her legs, very little use of her arms and hands, and is also totally blind. So, you know, she convinced me. I went and played my guitar for an hour and a half just because I couldn't, you know.
Yeah, and, well, she's. You know, she's got it a hell of a lot worse off than I do. But,
she does.
You know, but on the other hand, she's probably about as sharp as a tack. And
she is. Oh man, she's a wonderful lady.
Yeah, and so there's abilities where others where others wouldn't think there would be abilities. I prove people wrong every day. You know, people think, well, somebody's blind. Yeah. You know, they can't do this, can't do that.
Yeah, what did the guy said? You were, as a blind person, you're going to be judged by what you can do and not what you can't do.
Well, that's what I try to to teach people. I mean, every day is an education process for others, you know, and we try to just keep people aware of what reality is.
Yeah, you got high school. You got out in, sometime in the early 80s.
Yeah, 83, I graduated from high school.
What and you did all right as far as high school is concerned. You got out. What did you think you might want to be or do or go, or what were your thoughts then?
Well, you know, and I was involved in a lot of things in high school, too. You know, I was on the wrestling team. I was in music and chorus and things of that nature. And so I was pretty involved with a lot of different things and hung out with all my friends were, of course, sighted. And, you know, I ran around and got into trouble just like they did.
Good.
Just because I was blind didn't mean that, I didn't have to get in the same trouble they did.
Oh, yeah.
Plus, I was a cop's kid, so cop's kids and preacher's kids, the old story goes. You know?
So your father was a policeman?
Yes, he was.
Oh, really?
For 30 years, he was a policeman in Sioux Falls. So, I had it pretty good in all reality. My friends and I did, because the cops would see us out, and they were like, go home.
You know? Yeah, but I'm sure that the judgment of that policeman was pretty harsh on you. He expected you to do a little better than...
And it didn't matter if I was cited or not. They were just like, get home, damn it, or I'm calling your dad.
Yeah.
I go home.
Yeah. It's probably a good idea. So you got into normal high school, integrated with all the kids, and played and had a social life.
I had a great time in high school. You know, I still talk to a lot of my friends from high school and such, and we had a wonderful time. And I don't regret it for a minute. I really don't. And it was the best thing my parents could have ever done for me, is keep me in that public school system.
Yeah.
So I could grow up with all of my friends and the neighbors and experience all of the things that kids just don't get, in my opinion anyway. Kids just don't get that opportunity in an institutional setting.
Well, the only counterbalance to that is during your frustrating time of not being able to see, you had no other blind kids to relate to. I mean, in your world, you were the only one.
That's true. That is very true. And I think that, you know, school, for, you know, having access to that was a good thing. Actually, when I was going through that depression time when I was between seventh and eighth grade, my parents did call in a guy who was a rehab counselor who was blind. And him and I ended up developing a really good relationship over the years. But he, you know, he came and told me, you know, it ain't so bad. You know, you can do this, you can do that. And, you know, at that time I talked about, well, I want to get a guide dog someday. And they said, well, what do you do at, like, school dances and things like that? And he said, well, you know, I've taken more than one dog to a dance before, and she didn't have four legs, so, you know, of that nature. So, you know, I mean, he really kind of woke me up a little bit, and that's about the time I started kind of coming out of things. So.
Yeah, so high school was good for you. Well, that's good, because lots of kids who go to public school become isolated and don't fit in, and that's good that you did.
Well, I kind of made myself fit in, you know. I think if you wait for other people to do for you, it won't happen.
No, you're right.
And so, you know, it was me that made things happen for me. It wasn't somebody else doing it for me and getting it done. And that's in life that I taught myself early on, is that if I wanted something done, I'm going to have to do it myself, or, you know, I'm going to be overlooked. And so that's why my career in high school was as successful as I was.
Yeah, there's a little job that I would like to have, a little part-time job I would like to have, and I was thinking this morning, well, the only way you're going to get that, if you can get it, is call them. They're damn sure not going to call you, because they don't know you want it. You know, if you want it, you're going to have to call them.
That's exactly right. Exactly.
Now, so, I was thinking, do I want it that bad? Maybe not.
Yeah. So, you know, then I went to, when I was thinking about going to college and stuff, you know, kind of got a long way to your question there, but when I started about going to college, I was thinking I wanted to go into psychology or something like that.
Oh, okay.
And, well, after, you know, 1 year, I decided to change my major from psychology to mass communication. I took one psych class and figured out how screwed up I was, so I figured I really didn't need to get a degree in it.
Well, you know, you're laughing about that, but my wife and I have a little theory, or I guess it's not our theory, but a lot of people go to become psychology majors to try to figure out what's wrong with them.
Well, I think some people do, you know, and I joke about that, but I didn't have the interest in it that I thought I would, and so I went to an interest that I had a real strong interest in, and that was mass communication.
As in radio, television? As in
radio, television, marketing.
Yeah.
Advertising, all of that. It was kind of a broad-based four-year degree in that. And I did everything from, you know, video production, which is a real bitch when you can't see it,
Would be. But do you cut the tape the same? Is it the same as doing audio? Do you cut tape or not?
I mean, it was all electronic editing, so we didn't have to physically cut the tape like we did with the old reel-to-reel tape in audio. But I had to do it the same way as everybody else did. And actually, what I ended up doing is getting a friend of mine to do the cuts for me, and I just told him where to edit it at.
Yeah.
And teachers accepted that. They thought that was acceptable and understandable based on the situation. But
yeah.
But I ended up managing the college radio station, and I worked for public radio and did some board engineering for them. And
oh, is that right?
I did some time in commercial radio as well as my career went on, but.
So you manage the college radio station, which is just a little college where they train people to be announcers. I guess they read news and played music and all the things a normal radio station does.
Yep, no commercials but playing the music mainly for the students on campus and having to schedule people and get people there and train them how to use the equipment and. And if people don't show up, you got to make phone calls and chew people out for not showing up, just like they would any other time.
Or you got to
you don't fire them because you need the help.
or you got to work the shift.
Yeah, and I did that several times.
Yeah, I have too. What sort of equipment did they have? Had a board and turntables and cart machines.
Some old turntables, a couple of cart decks, and a console. Was it about an 8-channel, I think. And then right before I left, they started getting into CDs a little bit and they upgraded the equipment and stuff right before I left. I really didn't get much chance to use the new stuff, but.
This was a little FM station or what?
Yeah, it was a 200 watt FM station.
And this was the University of South Dakota or what?
University of Sioux Falls.
University of Sioux Falls.
Yeah, it's a little private college in Sioux Falls there.
So you were still living at home?
Actually, no. I lived in an apartment with a friend of mine.
Is that right?
I lived right close to campus so I could walk to classes and walk to work at the radio station and stuff instead of having to take transit.
But your interest was in radio, just like all the rest of us. You felt... fell victim to, it's such a natural thing for blind people.
Well, if you've got the talent for it.
Yeah.
I believed I did, and I was able to make some money at it throughout the years, so I must have had enough talent to get through.
To get by.
But I knew I was never going to make a living at it just because the pay is not there.
It's really not.
Somebody like Howard Stern to make money.
To make a living, you do. You can starve to death. It's radio. You get $30 a week and all the records you can eat.
Yeah.
That used to be the joke.
Yeah, I used to work overnight radio, though. I loved it when I was working rock and roll.
You got a degree.
Rock.
You got a degree, and then you found a job in radio, actually.
I did get a job in radio.
Ah. Uh-huh.
After I had a job in telemarketing that I got laid off from, but...
Yeah,
I got a job in radio and used it, and I really liked that job because I could, pretty much play what I wanted, unless the boss was up and he'd call me and ask me if that was on the playlist.
I've been both. I've been the boss and I've been the guy who was asked.
The one thing that I was always, my understanding was always there's two types of people in radio: those who have been fired and those who have yet to be fired. And luckily, I'm still in the second category.
You never were fired from a job.
I've never been fired from a radio job.
But you realized that overnight job wasn't where you needed to be. Wasn't going to make you a living.
It was to pay the bills. I was a newlywed at the time, and it paid the bills. It helped anyway.
Now, but you realize that you couldn't ever, as far as you were going to go, maybe. Might get middays and a $10 a week raise, and that'd be it.
Absolutely. Yep. you know, and I wasn't working in it full time, so I was just kind of the fill in when everybody was sick. Otherwise, I just worked weekends. So, yeah, so it wasn't a lot, but it was at least it was money while I needed it.
But when it was commercial radio, it's what you wanted to do.
Yep.
At was this at an FM there in Sioux Falls?
It was an FM in Sioux Falls. Yeah, they play. Yeah. They were a classic rock station. They played stuff from 70s rock. You know, a lot of Aerosmith.
Which you loved.
Yeah, I love that.
Oh yeah, you were born at that time.
Yeah, and you know we got into late '60s, '70s, and early '80s rock, and then some current, you know, album oriented rock as well.
Yeah.
We played.
All right, so you did that for a while, and you found a lady that you wanted to spend the rest of your life with, and you got married.
I did.
Now, how did you meet her? She's partially blind, also.
No, she's fully sighted.
She's fully sighted.
Yep.
Oh, is that right?
She's always been really open-minded. And that's really cool for us, you know. But blindness was really never an issue for her.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I would imagine she's one of those she forgets you're blind, you know.
Absolutely.
A lot
of people do, and that to me that's a compliment.
Oh, it is. It's a wonderful compliment. So you're a newlywed, and you were in radio, so you decided you're going to have to find a job.
Yep. And I was a client of Voc Rehab, you know, like most of us were at one point or another. And, an opportunity came for a job in Aberdeen, South Dakota, which is in the northern part of the state. They were just starting an independent living center up there.
Uh-huh.
And so I interviewed for that, and I got that job. And it was right at Thanksgiving time of 1990.
So it's time to move to Aberdeen.
Time to move to Aberdeen and, you know, find a place to live and move to Aberdeen. And I started that program up and really had to use my marketing skills that I had learned in college and how to, you know, promote a program, a brand new program that was, you know, designed to help people with all types of disabilities to be as independent as they can.
Yeah.
And, you know, they weren't really used to that idea. And, you know, one of the frustrating parts about that job was that Aberdeen is where the School for the Blind in South Dakota is. And so everybody thought, just because I was blind, that I worked there.
And you were starting a new program. This was for the state of South Dakota.
It was state funding that was paying for this program to provide services to all people with disabilities. You know, they didn't have a name. They just called it the Independent Living Program. And I kept trying, you know, I kicked around a lot of different ideas and ended up coming up with the name of Opportunities for Independent Living, which I thought was real positive. It showed a strong sense of disability or whatever, you know, disability pride or whatever you want to call it. And so Opportunities for Independent Living, you know, and we just called it OIL for short. And I always told people we were a slick organization.
Opportunities for Independent Living. Yep. OFIL, I guess.
Yeah, we just took the F out and just called it OIL.
Yeah, OIL. So and you were you were running this. You started this program. You founded it.
I started the program. I was the director and counselor and independent living aid, you know, teacher.
Uh-huh.
Everything in between. It was a one-person office.
Did they have physical facility when you got there, or did you have to set that up?
They had an office, but that was it. And, you know, I took it from the ground up and brought it up to, you know, it was a town of about 25,000 people. And I was serving, when I left that job to work for our protection and advocacy agency in Pierre, there was probably about 30 people that I was working with at the time.
So you had to find a secretary and get everything set up and everything rolling.
Yeah, and we were kind of housed in another office, so we could use some of the support staff from that office and some of their office space and that mm-hmm. kind of thing. But it was a new program. It was a new concept. You know, the ADA was new, so I had to, you know, really learn a lot about the Americans with Disabilities Act. And it was really a challenging job. It was exciting, but after 2 years, I kind of got it going. It was something time for me to move on to something else.
But now, this wasn't just for blind people. This was for disabled folks of all kinds.
Absolutely. And there were some people who were blind that I worked with, but most of the people were people like with MS or traumatic brain injury was a real popular one.
Now, what were you trying to do? Were you trying to find them jobs, or were you trying to make them feel better about the handicap, or what?
Well, some of it was, you know, trying to make them feel better about their disability and that it shouldn't stand in their way. A lot of it was teaching advocacy skills, teaching them how to speak up for themselves, helping them find a decent place to live if they didn't have a place.
Uh-huh.
You know, I remember there was a lady that had MS that, was going to be going through what ended up being a pretty nasty divorce because she was disabled now. Her husband and family really didn't want to do anything to do with her.
Well, man, that's pretty sad.
This lady had no self-esteem whatsoever, and she was in a small town outside of where Aberdeen at home and no transportation, and so she just didn't know what to do, and I got that lady to a point to where I helped her get a place to live. I helped her fight with her landlord to get it accessible. And ultimately, even after I was gone, she got a job working at Walmart, and she ended up being one of the people recognized by the governor of our state as being an employee with a disability for the year. I don't remember what year that was, but that lady went a long way from where she started, and I helped get her there. And that was really fun to see.
I would imagine that would be rewarding since you'd had somewhat of a struggle as a blind person at different times.
Absolutely.
I can see how. But so you were just an advocate for the for these people. More or less.
I was more an advocate than anything else, but I was also kind of a peer counselor. I was, a person that taught, people how to use adaptive devices like in the kitchen and that kind of thing. Some of the specialized cutting tools utility knives and that kind of thing.
So you did some in-home visiting.
Some in-home visiting and training. But, you know, I ended up working with, developing things through the hospital and working with the occupational and physical therapy people because they were doing kind of the same thing as I was. And I thought, why can't I get these people connected with other people that know more about it than I do?
Yeah.
And so I started doing that, and that worked out as a real good partnership. It really did. It was great.
Okay, but you did 2 years there. State jobs, you never want to quit a state job. You know that, though, right?
Well, that wasn't a state job. It was state money, but it was a kind of a private nonprofit kind of thing. So.
Okay, so but after 2 years, you decided that you wanted to move on, move back to Sioux Falls? Or
when an opportunity came up to manage a program called the Protection and Advocacy of Individual Rights Program, which is, they call it the PEAR program. It's uh-huh. a part of the state advocacy network, the protection and advocacy. Kind of like in rehab, there's a client assistance program. It's kind of a sister program to that.
Uh-huh.
And so I had that opportunity come up, and I was able to get the job, and I worked in that field for about 5.5 years. And that was in Pierre, and that's what got me to Pierre in the first place was that job.
Yeah.
And that job involved a lot of, representing people at hearings, if someone was being discriminated against by a landlord, or whatever.
Really?
I could contact the landlord and point out the law to them and try to communicate with them and use a little common sense before I said, well, if you don't do what we ask you, the right thing and what we ask you to do, we'll just sick our lawyers on you,
And you ended up having to do that at different times.
Sometimes we did. Sometimes we'd have to file, civil rights complaints you know, on behalf of the individual. But most often, a lot of issues can be resolved by just, you know, having some decent communication and some good advocacy. And to me, good advocacy is not only just speaking up for yourself, but knowing what you're talking about.
Yeah, but
that really helped a lot.
But you did have a lawyer that would help you if you needed it.
Absolutely, I had a lawyers on staff that I could use as resources, and I also had lawyers that could actually represent people if need be.
Now, where was this? This was what city?
This was in Pierre, state capital.
Which is the state capital?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you moved there, you and your wife.
Yep, me and my wife at the time.
All right, now.
And that was in 1993.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 years later, we had a son. And he's now 11. It's hard to believe.
Is that right? So he was born in 95. At least fixed to be 12, Jeff.
He's almost, in March he'll be 12.
In March he'll be 12. Yeah, and that's the son that you were dealing with Friday.
Right, I went to his wrestling.
That's good.
Practice and stuff. Yeah.
So, how long did you stay in the capital?
Well, we're still in the capital area. Pierre is across the river from Fort Pierre. I live in Fort Pierre and still work in Pierre.
So. And so, you go across the river every morning to your job.
Yeah, we go from the Mountain Time Zone to the Central Time Zone every day.
Are you kidding? Is that right?
The river, right at this point, the river divides the time zone.
And so you change time zones every day.
Well, legitimately, I mean, we're close enough, you know, since Pierre and Fort Pierre are tied so closely together, we follow Central Time. Except the bars, they stay open later, of course.
Oh, that's weird. That is, I guess it's got to change somewhere, and that happens to be where it changes.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, in the summertime, it's really cool because it's, you know, it's actually light out until almost 10 o'clock. Because we're right on that border. You
I
know,
guess that's true.
Changes.
Boy, and they're going to change early this year. They're changing in March this year. Did you know that?
Yeah, it's like the early part of March, and then it's like the first weekend in November where it changes back. So it's even after Halloween this year.
Yeah, we're changing. They're changing the 11th of March this year. So we now have 8 months of daylight saving time.
Yeah, which, you know, I mean, to me, it's neither here nor there.
Doesn't bother me one bit. I just set the clocks and go right on.
The golfers like it, but I think, you know, that's about it. Just the farmers are going to get up and do it regardless. So.
So you stayed, is this the job you're still with? Because you're still with the state, right?
Well, that job was with a contract agency for the state. Now, for the last 8 years, I've worked for the state, working in the area of assistive technology and the business enterprise program, which is the blind vending program.
Yeah,
we manage that for our state.
You manage that for the state and you're the manager?
I'm the administrator or the manager of the blind vending program in the state.
But I thought you said the other day that you didn't come in contact with many blind people.
Well, I don't. Other than work, I don't. You know, and that's what the difference is that other than my job of working with Service to the Blind and Visually Impaired, in my life, I really don't have a lot of contact with other people who are blind.
Because you don't actually go out and set up the vending stands. You are just the administrator.
I administrate it, right, you know, and recruit. You know, if we have a stand to where we have to replace somebody or if we get a new location, then I recruit.
Mm-hmm.
And then we utilize our current vendors to provide training and orientation to that individual in the area of operating the business and that kind of thing. And then I help them with the finances and that kind of thing and get them connected and working in that area. But
how many vending stands do you have?
We have, you know, 10 across the state.
In post offices and government buildings and...
Yeah, the post offices, a couple of federal buildings, and then, you know, there's a place called the Aeros Data Center that is a satellite interpretation location. It's surrounded by cornfields is what it is, but it's in a flat piece of land that is, you know, real perfect for that kind of business. And actually a lot of the satellites, like with Katrina a couple of years ago, all of the satellite images that showed the damages were all processed there.
And are you actively looking for other locations or just dealing with the ones you got?
Well, you know, it's hard enough just to keep the ones that we've got open in a small state like South Dakota.
Yeah.
It's hard to get people that are younger to want to work as hard as those blind vendors do work. And, you know, they do work hard. They put in long days, and then they do book work at night. You know, it's like being a teacher, it seems like, you know, teachers.
Yeah.
Put in long hours.
But a good stand will make a guy a good living.
Yes, it will. If you take, you know, if you make the right approaches, you can make a ton of money in these locations.
Yeah.
And you know, have a good business technique.
And you and your wife just have the one son?
We just have the one son, and I'm kind of in the middle of guide dogs right now, so I don't have one. But that'll change in a week.
But you're going in a week to get another guide dog?
Yeah.
Well, sounds like your life is rolling along pretty good.
It's busy.
41-year-old family man. A lot of people like to be where you are with a nice family, a son, a new guide dog coming up, nice job, a little security. Looks like you.
I'm in a rural area. I love it.
Looks like you've got it made.
Yeah, if we you can just, do have it pretty well. You know, and I like to try to be involved with my son.
Yeah.
In his activities in school, he's pretty busy, and so just keeping up with one is plenty. And he is one amazing kid. He's a drummer in the school band, and
really,
and he wrestles and he plays baseball, and he doesn't know if he wants to play football or not. He's a great size for it, but. You know, it can be a pretty rough sport.
Oh, it can.
And, you know, maybe his interest is going to be the music and beat the skins instead of beating somebody.
Well, you have to be an aggressive, you have to be pretty aggressive to play football. We've got a nephew that's about 6'2 and weighs about 220, and he doesn't want to play. He's a baseball player. He doesn't want to play football. He's just not mean enough. You know, he's not.
Yeah.
He can't bring himself to just tackle a guy. You know, he
absolutely.
Just...
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, you really have to. It's certainly a mentality that people have to have.
Now, I've done so many, of course, it would be natural that I'd forget, and I do forget. Are you the one that was having a snowblower problem several years ago? Was that you? Or am I thinking of somebody else?
I don't think so. It wasn't me.
It wasn't you.
I might have given some of the suggestions. You know, I don't know what. As far as being able to use the snowblower,
you do have one.
Yeah, I have one, and I've used it for years. You know, it's kind of like with mowing the lawn. It's a matter of you know, spending a lot of extra time and missing stuff and going back and getting it. But you know, using the snowblower is kind of like the same concept as far as I'm concerned as using the lawnmower.
Well, yeah, but with a snowblower, it would be a lot easier to tell if you'd done a good job or not.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It would be easy because you'd know where the snow was. I mean, it would still be there if you hadn't blown it off to the side of the...
Yeah.
Of the,
we've got deep snow, especially. You can really find out.
But maybe...
I know that some people really struggle with the concept, you know, but I guess... You just have to kind of get your ground, your footing straight, and try to balance, you know, figure out where you're at and where you need to be. And you know, with the way that I do my driveway, for example, it's a double garage driveway with, that I go side to side instead of from the door down to the street, which is longer. It's a take a less distance than I don't. It isn't as difficult. It's more difficult to get lost when you're going in a longer distance.
Well, sure it would be. So you start at the top of the driveway up by the garage, and you go across the driveway.
Right. I go along, like, the first strip is along the garage door, so that I have a good straight line of path to start with.
Okay. And then you
work my way down the driveway that way.
Blowing it all off to the side of the driveway, clearing.
Yeah.
So
well,
that
I'm going straight over to my neighbor's driveway.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Blowing it right over to your neighbor's driveway so Mama can back the car out.
That's right.
That's the whole point, is clearing a path so she can get the car out to take you to work and your son to school.
That's right.
Every morning.
Yeah, she takes us. She takes me to work, and then she takes him to school. And I take the public transit as like a door-to-door service here that I'm able to use. So I bring that transit home, and it works out pretty well.
Oh, so she takes you one way, and then you come home on public transit the other way.
Yep.
Yeah. Have you found her a job yet?
My wife?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. She works hard. She works for the Retailers Association. She's home now, so I can say that.
Yeah, she's
really.
Yeah.
But no, she does work hard. She works for the South Dakota Retailers Association, and she's also taking two classes in college at night. So.
So I guess
she's a busy woman.
I guess where you live every day is practically a snowblower day, because you have snow almost all winter, don't you?
Well, we do when it snows. You know, we've only gotten one good snowstorm this year so far. And we're kind of in a drought, a pretty bad drought, about a six-year drought. So we could really use lots of snow. Nobody is really complaining when it does snow.
Is that right? Whereas most years you get just a ton of snow all the time.
Yeah, in a normal year, we probably get, 50 inches of snow a year.
And you've gotten how much this year?
We've gotten about, I think, 18 inches this year. So
man, Colorado got all your snow, too, didn't they?
Yeah, they sure did. They've gotten everybody's snow.
All right, sir, we're going to go and let you, I guess, and it's getting on to 5:30. It'll be supper time here pretty quick.
I'll have to figure out what we're going to make tonight.
I think I'm gonna let her bring home some tacos. We made soup on Saturday and stew yesterday, so I think it's a eat out. I think it's tacos tonight from Taco Bell.
Oh,
or someplace.
Work.
It does sound good, doesn't it?
We made nachos last night while we were watching the football game on TV.
Yeah. Were you happy with the results?
I was okay with it. My son is a Patriots fan. He wasn't very happy about it, but. He'll get over it. I let him get into our office, playoff pool, and
yeah,
he picked the Patriots to win it all, and so now he was thinking, geez, I'm not going to get that $100.
Well, that's part of growing up, part of being an adult.
Let him learn early, right?
Let him learn early, yeah.
So, but yeah, I appreciate you asking me to be a part of this.
Well, I feel like I know you. You've been on Handyman two or three times, and now you've done this. We never stop until we know all there is to know about someone,
Well, just keep prying.
We do.
When you get to a spot that I don't want to tell you, I'll let you know.
Well, listen, tell your folks hello, and we'll talk to you in a day or two, and I'll let you know when this runs, Jeff.
That sounds great, Phil. Thank you very much. Have a great week.
I'll do it. I'll talk with you. Let's start a watch here and get a time. Occasionally we like to do a follow-up interview with somebody. Someone whom we've had on the show previously to kind of see how they were doing. And this girl is a perfect example. Lisa Hall, how are you?
I'm doing just great.
And I think last time, like we said last time we talked to you, you were still in San Antonio, Texas.
That was correct.
And what were you doing at that time?
At that time, I was going through Northwest Vista College working on a certificate for a textbook for a transcriber.
Which you got?
Yes. I received that. I went on across stage on May the 9th, 2005.
Did you walk across stage and got your diploma?
And an ovation.
Must have been a proud moment. Were you the only blind there?
Yes, it was. It was a very proud moment. I had a couple of church friends of mine that was there. And one of my other blind friend that was there. try to get as many people there, but, you know, a lot of people just can't always make those kind of occasions.
And let's see, you from, and so now came the time to find a job as a Braille transcriber, right?
Finding a job as a Braille transcriber was very, very challenging. It was not easy. A lot of jobs are not always listed on the Internet, but I happened to come across around the end of April 2006 an opportunity through the America's Job Bank on the Internet at www.ajb.org, an opportunity as a Braille proofreader. And I looked at the job description. I looked at my qualification. One of the qualification was you either have to be either a certification in both Braille transcribing and proofreading, or one or the other. And I was able to meet one of those qualifications.
All right, because finding a job as a Braille transcriptionist is a would be a very specialized thing. I mean, not ever.
Yes, it's a very specialized field. We don't have much recognition. If you were to look up anything in the Occupational Outlook Handbook, it's not listed anywhere at all, and we do not have any kind of identifiable profession.
Yeah, like Walmart wouldn't need one.
No.
Target wouldn't need one.
They can, you know, if they wanted, if a blind consumer were to request any type of material like manual for their particular appliance that they may have purchased, they can contact any one of our small businesses people or even non-profit organizations, us in Quivernook.
Yeah, to get that
would produce some material.
To get that material transcribed. Okay, now, so this meant a move from San Antonio. What did you do while you were looking for a job? What did you live on there? Your government money?
I was living on Social Security disability at the time.
Uh-huh.
It was not easy, just surviving just on that. And I was also doing some contract work for Region 20 Education Service Center, doing some proofreading for them, doing some public relations work for Ozone Publishing. And I was going to do one for Braille International, doing some proofreading for them, but at that time I was supposed to be moving into a publicized, to a public housing, but that didn't happen either.
Yeah. So this job, this entailed a move, this Clovernook job. In Clovernook is where? It's in
Cincinnati, Ohio.
Cincinnati, Ohio. And
yeah, and they're one of the major producers of Braille books. We're one of the five agencies that produce books for the Library of Congress. And what really impressed me about this organization is that they produce 40 million pages of Braille a year with 160 titles a year.
Really?
In production. And I think we have roughly about 16 people that are blind that are doing Braille production.
Now, but and this is Clovernook's main thing, is they produce Braille.
That's
Braille.
One of the main missions.
Yeah.
But there are other areas that they do specialize in, such as rehabilitation, getting people placed in competitive employment, and they also have a manufacturing facility where they do produce paper products such as paper cups and file folders for the federal government.
Now, that's more of a workshop situation.
Yes.
Of employing people.
The Braille production facility is separate. So it's not part of the Jarvis Wagner O'Day Act.
How many Braille proofreaders are there? I think you say 16?
I think there's roughly about 10 to 16 people that are blind.
So you said
Could be a little bit off because we do have some people not only doing Braille proofreading, but there are some that are doing binding of the books. And then we have some people that are, a couple of people that are, or at least the one I know in particular, that are running the plate machines before they go into Braille production.
So you sit all day long and read Braille books?
I read Braille books with a sighted copy holder, and each copy holder comes to my office each day. I have a different one that's assigned to me. And
copy holder, what are you talking about? I don't understand.
Well, copy holders are sighted people, either they're volunteers or they're part of our staff, and they will sit down and, with a print book or the copy of whatever that we may have generated. And we will sit down and we would take turns reading all day long.
I would read the page
and they read odd.
So you read a page and they read a page and you make sure that your text corresponds. What if
they write the report in print. If we find any errors, I will tell them what the error is and what should be corrected. I will, in turn, also put an audio recording on cassette
okay.
to the next person, whoever's going to do the correcting of the file.
All right. Now, if that's what you do if you find an error. Mm-hmm. Would you, just in kind of closing here, and congratulations on your job and your tenacity in finding a job because you were a little disheartened, I think, last time I talked to you. You weren't?
Yeah, it was a challenge. I worked at Sears. I was getting at a point while working at Sears. I was kind of getting burnt out.
You were very frustrated.
I knew that, I was going to have to find a niche that would be much more appropriate for me, that wouldn't be so much stress.
All right. Would you recommend this path for others?
Yes, I would. It's a challenging field. You have to work hard to be able to earn that certificate. Northwest Vista College now has an online curriculum that people can take anywhere in the United States, no matter where they live. They can be able to take this course in 3 semesters. It's a real hard course. And, of course, it does lead to continuing education in the future to specialize in specific areas such as music, math and science, and computer science stuff.
All right. Lisa Hall from Cincinnati, Ohio, good luck and thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as we tell everybody, we do about 80 shows a year, counting the blind handyman and blind like me. We always need guests. We always need people to be on the shows. And if you know somebody that you think would make us a good guest, or maybe you would like to be a part of the show, it's very easy. We do our best to make it as stress-free as possible to make everybody comfortable because, we're not trying to be CBS Radio or the NBC or anything. We're just trying to introduce some blind folks to being blind that may be having problems, may be thinking their blindness means the end of the world. Well, we know, us who have dealt with it all our lives, no, it isn't. And that's our message to convey to other blind people who recently lost their eyesight or maybe have a little fear about being blind. It's a tough thing to do, but it can be done because most of us have done it, right? Anyway, contact us. I'm Phil Parr, and my email address is phil@philparr.net. phil@philparr.net. That will get you in touch with me. We try to keep a little guest list and keep some guests ahead. So if you've contacted us, we haven't gotten back in touch, don't worry, we will. We've got a nice guest file, and we always need guests for both shows, The Blind Handyman and this show. Thank you for listening, and we'll do it again next week. And come see us and give us a call. 936-634-9500 is my phone number. I'm Phil Parr. Bye-bye. Thank you.